Hear you. Going through a canyon. She made static noises with her mouth and then hung up. He looked over at the mechanics and the diamondback, found himself rooting for the snake. The meter clicked off, and he seated the nozzle and drove away. Hours more of hammered flat terrain, and then all of a sudden the road smoothed out, fresh asphalt with bright lane markings pointing the way. Illuminated in the headlights, the ranches and farms looked cleaner, with nice tractors and split-rail fences and cotton crops blooming from well-tended soil. As he neared Eden, he saw that the lower-middle-class houses were also better cared for. Pride of ownership evident in the paint, swept gutters, and curated lawns and gardens. The high school boasted a new-looking sign announcing the Eden Rattlers. A re-roofing job on the main building was paused for the night, bundles of asphalt shingles and tar mops awaiting a new day. He steered through the two stoplights and scattering of shops that constituted town. A saloon-style bar showed signs of life through neon-glazed windows. The florist next door had nothing to offer but empty window displays and barren interior shelves and refrigerated units. A magic-markered sign hung on the door proclaimed sold out, closed until further notice. A coffee shop and a grocery market, a taqueria and a thrift store, a barber shop and a tattoo parlor. A lawyer who'd hung out a shingle seemed to have cornered the market on wills, personal injury claims, and servicios legales de inmigración. 10 minutes past town, up a long and deserted road ideal for surveillance and ambushes, loomed the razor-wire-topped 12-foot-high concrete block wall surrounding Aragon Urrea's vast compound. Spotlit by the enclave's high beams, it looked impregnable. Two men stood at the huge main gate. Everything about them screamed private military contractors. Timberland boots, Casio G-Shocks, desert-colored canvas pants, slate-gray Rothko tactical softshell jackets over Nike dry-fit polo shirts. The PMCs held AR-15 clones with what looked to be 16-inch barrels, noteworthy for a number of reasons. Unlike the MP7s or full-auto AK-47s favored by the cartels, AR-15s were legal for private civilian use, which put these guards on the right side of the law. The 5.56 NATO ammo that the semi-automatic rifles employed was readily available in this area of operation, which meant the men were Boy Scout prepared. They kept their AR-15s off sling in a parade carry over their right shoulders, hands cradling the butt plates, a lazy, undisciplined carry method that reached back to when foot soldiers hauled spears and pikes. It subsisted because certain mouth breathers thought the pose looked good enough to post on weapons porn websites. Evan parked at a good distance and opened the door immediately, wanting the dome light to afford the PMCs a reassuring view of him. Unrushed, he got out, standing so the fan of zip ties rising from his back pocket remained out of sight. Surveillance cameras atop the wall swiveled to note his progress. He wondered how many more he had passed along the desolate road here. How many more heavily armed PMCs there were around the perimeter. And how many more inside. He drew in a breath, reaching for the 9th commandment. Always play offense. And then he approached. As he did, the PMCs moved their long guns to a port arms position, angled diagonally across their chest, muzzle above their support side shoulder. An improvement from parade carry, which wasn't saying much. The broader of the two PMCs said, "Can we help you, sir?" "I'm here to see Aragon Urrea, at his behest." "We can neither confirm nor deny that he resides here." The man smacked his gum a few times. Blonde hair buzz cut tight enough that a pink, sunburned scalp showed through. The edge of a sleeve tattoo peeked out from his cuff, no doubt a snake or a skull or some combination thereof. "This is an unannounced visit on privately owned land." His polo shirt sported a crest with wings, some private company no doubt licensed and vetted and in tight with the DOD. As expected, Urrea was covering all his legal bases. Evan halted a few feet from the men, dead center between them. "Sir," the guard continued in a slightly bored drawl, "I'd like to edify you that these firearms are registered in accordance with state and federal law, and that Texas is a stand-your-ground state. We have every right under state law to shoot you as you are trespassing on private property after dark." "Consider me edified," Evans said. The partner piped up. "We are within our legal rights to respond with deadly force if you don't heed our commands." His words, too, were flattened, rehearsed. "I would like to make clear, we don't want to start a fight, but we will finish one." Buzz cut again. "We will ask you a second time to evacuate the premises. Your unlawful intrusion and unwillingness to obey our clear sequence of commands is being recorded right now." Evans squinted thoughtfully and gazed up at the surveillance cameras topping the front gate. The units looked like robotic heads atop articulated necks. "Is that right?" A whirring sound drew the guard's attention. The camera heads were shaking their heads back and forth. "No." "Looks like you lost your backup," Evans said to the men. Again, to the cameras. "Do you think these gentlemen have any idea what they're in for?" Another whirring sound as the cameras shook their heads once more. "Should I do it now?" Evan asked. A different pitch of whirring as the cameras nodded. The guards gazed slack-jawed up at the treacherous surveillance equipment, trying to process this sudden perfidy. Evan closed the distance between himself and the PMCs with a single long lunge, grabbing both barrels a half foot above the handguards and shoving them to the right. The men reacted reflexively by yanking the barrels to the left. Evan reversed direction with them, augmenting the momentum and smacking the front sight towers against their temples. They crumbled in tandem. Evan stripped their rifles and then crouched over the men, zip-tied them at the ankles and wrists, and rolled them to the base of the wall. He drew a key card from the breast pocket of the bigger man and held it against the pad beside the gate. The gate clicked and swung open accommodatingly. Evan looked up at the cameras, doffed an imaginary hat at his 16-year-old niece person on the other side of the digital connection, and entered. What struck him first was the open stretch of land, partially lit. Whitewashed adobe storage facilities rose at sporadic intervals, along with a massive propane tank, a water tower, and a generator visible through the open door of a shed. As he neared the shed, a chubby man exited holding a styrofoam takeout box filled with Chinese noodles, plastic fork halfway to his mouth, a massive pistol shoved into a hip holster. Evan recognized him as Enrique, a.k.a. Kiki, a.k.a. Special K. He came face to face with Evan, started, and dropped the box. Evan knocked him in the larynx with a four-knuckle strike just gentle enough not to collapse his windpipe. Kiki choked and reached for his throat with both hands. Evan flipped the pistol free of the holster, tossing it behind him, then slid one leg behind Kiki's ankles, took him firmly by the shoulders, and dumped him onto the ground. "You're okay," he said. "You'll find air in a moment." He zip-tied Kiki and turned him onto his side, resting a hand on his well-padded ribs until the lungs released to let in a screech of air. "Don't scream or shout, or I'll hit you again," Evan said. "Understand?" Kiki nodded, his cheek burrowing in the dirt. "How many more of you are there?" Kiki's eyes strained up to take Evan in. Then his mouth twitched upward, a smile Evan caught a second too late. He jerked away, a haymaker coming from behind him, glancing off his shoulder and knocking him to the ground. Another man, the size of an NFL linebacker, stood over him. Special Ed was just as ugly in real life, but much larger than Evan had anticipated. Now that Evan was clear of Kiki, Special Ed readied his right hand, which happened to be holding a Glock 21 with a shiny chrome slide. Evan swung a steel-toed boot into Eduardo's crotch, and the man coughed out a clump of air, doubling over, pistol tumbling. Evan snatched at his wrist, ripped the arm toward him, and spun around Eduardo's torso as he fell. The man struck the earth flat on his back, hard enough to raise a puff of dust, One of Evan's legs scissored around his wide neck, the other knee wedged into his armpit. Evan arched away, holding him captive in an armbar. The tumble brought Evan face to face with Kiki, who looked on with bulging eyes, sweat beading on his forehead, mustache fluttering with strained exhalations. They stared at each other as Evan held pressure on Eduardo's arm. The limbs strained a centimeter or two shy of the snapping point. The joint bent the wrong way across the fulcrum of Evan's inner thigh. The back of Evan's knee cinched down on Eduardo's neck, choking off his air supply. Evan lessened the pressure only slightly, listened to Eduardo take in a sip of air. "I'm going to let go," Evan said, "and you're going to let me cuff you. Understand?" Eduardo's voice came strained.
"Break my arm. You're not getting to Aragon."
"I'm not here to hurt him. He asked for me."
"Don't care. See what happens. You let go of me, motherfucker."
Evan cinched off his air again. Eduardo thrashed a bit, but had nowhere to go. "This is the kind of exchange you regret later," Evan said quietly. "Not just immediately after, when the pain hits, and you're curled up here in the dirt with your elbow dislocated and the tendons snapped. But the months of rehab, when you're old and the arm aches in the morning, in the winter, when you can't sleep on your side." He leaned back another millimeter, his shoulders seated firmly against the ground. At his side, he could hear Kiki breathing hard. "And that's assuming I stop at your arm. So weigh your anger now against a lifetime of pain. I'm going to give you until 3, 2. Eduardo tapped Evan's calf twice, a show of surrender, and Evan released him and swung quickly away. The big man kept his word, cradling his elbow for a moment and then rolling onto his stomach. Evan got the plastic cuffs around his ankles and wrists, leaving him face down in the dirt next to his pal. Then he patted Eduardo's pockets, found a laden keyring in his left cargo pocket that pulled free with a promising jangle. "Do I need to gag you?" he asked. Both men shook their heads. Evan popped up and moved swiftly toward the interior of the compound. A few other PMCs walked patrols in the distance, but it was clear that their guard was down here inside the razor-topped walls. He waited for them to drift away. As he came clear of the last of the maintenance structures, he found himself confronting an open plain of land without any cover. Nowhere to go but forward. He ran, keys hard against his palm, praying for something to hide behind. 10 meters. 30. Still nothing. He'd gone about the length of a football field when suddenly the main residence resolved from the darkness. At first, Evan wasn't sure he was seeing what he was seeing. He paused a moment to behold it. It looked as though a two-story house had been spatulated up out of a middle-class suburb and plunked down directly on the hard Texas dirt. Even the land itself seemed to have been transplanted. Perfect green sod rolled down over the unforgiving terrain. A standard front yard complete with a decorative white picket fence and a mailbox with a red flag. Given the grandiosity of the concrete block wall, the 250-acre sprawl of the compound, and the vastness of Urrea's operation, Evan expected a mansion 15 or 20 times the size of the modest house before him. He gazed in disbelief. White clapboard, black trim, gables, shingle roof, a humble porch with a swing. A few sprinklers chop, chop, chopped a fine mist across the perfect strips of Bermuda grass. It was as surreal as finding a perfect square of turf grafted onto a parking lot. Evan turned a slow 360, scanning his surroundings. But there were no guards in view, no other buildings even, nothing but the steady sawing of cicadas reverberating in the humid air. As he finished the full circle, it struck him that he half expected the house to have disappeared, proving itself a figment of his imagination. But no, there it was, set down as if by sleight of hand or alien intervention. He stepped across onto the edge of the lawn, his boot cushioned by the soft blades. It felt like stepping into another reality. The smell of fresh-cut grass was sharp enough that he could taste it. Out of respect for the carefully tended sod, he moved to the paved front walk. With a creak, a knee-high gate gave way under his knuckles. He checked the darkness at his back once more. It struck him that the house was withdrawn from the perimeter activity for privacy's sake. A normal family home. He walked up to the front door, his fingers searching the key ring for the most likely candidate. The lock gave on his first try. He took a deep breath and eased inside. Chapter 14. Strange Bedfellows. The first thing that hit him was the scent of roses. He moved through the short foyer, a living room unfolding to his right, the kitchen to his left. Flowers blanketed every surface, and his mind tracked back to the florist he'd passed on his way here. Sold out. Closed until further notice. He lifted a card from a bouquet of sunflowers and read a scrawled prayer for Angelina, signed by a family of four. A spray of sterling roses on the crowded mantel sported a similar sentiment from a different family. The design of the house, the layout, art, appliances, was wholly unremarkable. Department store sofa set, family photos on a glass coffee table, framed prints of sunsets and fruit bowls. There was mail on the kitchen's tile counter, dishes in the sink, shoes set in a basket by the front door. A few drips of a coffee stain marred the carpet of the fourth stair. Evan's footfall was silent on the way up. Four bedrooms upstairs, three closed doors. The open one led into a small empty study. He figured the room on the end for the master. He withdrew his Strider knife, snagged the shark fin topping the blade against the outside corner of his pocket so it snicked open. Photographs lined the walls, Angelina through the years. The door handle was cheap brass, cool beneath his palm. The hinges were silent. A king-size sleigh bed made of light oak that showed the grain and knots. Pale gray early morning light starting to leak around the edges of the curtains, bringing into relief the single form slumbering beneath the sheets. Evan padded across the room silently and stood over the man. Aragorn Urrea slept on his side, his eyelids puffy. Even in sleep, his mouth had a patrician scent to it. A dense shock of dark hair shot through with silver, pronounced chin, the pressure of his cheek against the pillow coaxing jowls into distinguished existence. Evan lowered the blade against Urrea's Adam's apple. Aragorn's eyes opened. Moving only his pupils, he stared up at Evan. "You called," Evan said. "Here I am." Aragorn blinked up at Evan a few times, taking his measure. "Thank you," Aragorn said. "I will do anything to get my daughter back." "What's it worth to you?" Evan asked. Aragorn cleared his throat, his stubble rasping against the blade. "Everything." "Your kingdom?" "Yes." "Your life?" "Yes." "If I help you," Evan said, "I will make demands of you, some of which you will not like."
"I understand."
Aragorn remained perfectly frozen, perfectly calm. "As I understand why you make this point at the edge of a blade." From across the room came the sound of a throat clearing. Aragorn still did not move, but his eyes pulled to the doorway, as did Evan's. Latia, the woman who had raised Urrea, stood in the doorway. Already dressed for the day, she wore a high-necked blouse, and her white hair was elaborately blow-dried upward, striking a contrast with her deep brown skin. She regarded the two of them down the length of her nose disapprovingly.
"Is this him?"
Aragorn said, "Yes, Tia." Her gaze shifted to Evan. He kept his fist around the knife handle, the blade resting against Urrea's throat.
"It's enough, muchachos," she said with a measure of irritation. "Downstairs. I'll cook you some eggs."
She withdrew. Evan looked back down at Aragorn.
You heard the woman,
Aragorn said.
If you think you're tough, wait till you see what happens if we're late for breakfast.
Evan heeded Aragorn's advice and removed the knife from his throat. It was the best goddamn plate of migas Evan had ever tasted. Steaming hot eggs scrambled with chorizo, pico de gallo, diced jalapenos. He ate heartily, shoving mouthfuls onto his fork with the edge of a griddle-warmed corn tortilla. To his side, a sliding glass door led out onto a stretch of rolled sod and hard land, the perimeter fence little more than a dark streak in the distance. Aragorn watched him, arms folded high across his chest.
Here, try this, he said,
spooning up tomatillo chipotle salsa from his plate and dolloping it across Evan's food. He used his fork to mix it a bit, took a bite from Evan's plate to sample.
There, he said. Good.
Evan fought down his OCD, tried another forkful.
Even better.
Over at the stove, Latia had not stopped bustling. She'd moved the flowers onto the floor, clearing her operating space. Her motions seemed choreographed, kneeing the refrigerator door closed, sliding pans from high burners to medium, pivoting to put away a dish, drying it until it slid from her towel-covered hands into place in a cupboard. I use a soy chorizo, she said to no one in particular, her back still turned. For his cholesterol. Evan finished and rose from the round wooden kitchen table to clear his plate. Without looking at him, she said, sit. He obeyed, and she whirled around the counter to pluck his plate off the table. She eyed Aragorn's.
Something wrong with my migas this morning?
I can't find my appetite.
She scowled at him.
At some point you'll have to. Your daughter needs you strong.
She swept his plate away and busied herself washing dishes in the sink. Evan said, may I help you clean?
No,
Latia said.
Would you like more juice?
A glass jug of orange juice rested on the counter between them. Evan said, yes, and stayed put. She brought the jug to him and refilled his glass. He nodded his thanks, and she withdrew to the sink once more. Aragorn studied Evan.
Senor Nowhere Man, he said, flesh and bones spun into a legend.
No one measures up to a myth.
No.
And yet, here you are, Aragorn said, inside a home,
a real home.
And just as you tested me upstairs, you have been tested here. How? Everyone is appraised when they share a meal. Do you belong here? Do you pay attention? Will you abide by the rules of our family? Will you show respect? Aragorn nodded toward Latia, vigorously scrubbing a pan under steaming water. 2 times you offered to help. A man who doesn't offer to help cannot be trusted. 2 times she rebuffed you. The 3rd time, you didn't ask.
What's that tell you?
That you're not too eager to please. That also cannot be trusted in a man.
You were raised right.
I was raised rough.
That's irrelevant, Aragorn said.
It has nothing to do with rough or gentle. Privileged or broke, everyone has their own path to the light. Sometimes those of us who came up hard are forced to see what actually matters. If we survive, that is. The world doesn't allow us not to see. We are forced into understanding.
Into grace.
It's either that or prison. Or drugs. Or the cold, hard earth.
Evan looked into the family room. A row of antique volumes lined a bookcase. They were sorted by height. Except for one that was out of place, higher than its neighbors. The sight of it scratched at Evan's OCD, and he returned his focus to the table, aligned his fork and knife with the edge of the placemat. He wondered what he was doing, enjoying a home-cooked breakfast in the middle of an armed compound in South Texas. He wondered at the closed bedroom doors upstairs and why Aragorn slept separately from his wife. He wondered what Angelina was doing right now, or what was being done to her.
You didn't ask me here to discuss manners, Evan said, or grace.
Didn't I?
Aragorn said. How can I trust someone with my daughter's life who is not a good man? And yet you're a drug lord. Aragorn shrugged. I'm a captain of industry. That doesn't interest me, Evan said. Tell me how your daughter was taken. A cadre of armed men. Eight of them armed with MP7s. Dia de los Muertos sugar skull masks. Leones ink on their forearms. They stormed the community center, snatched her, took off in three black SUVs. I'll want to see the place, Evan said. Talk to witnesses.
Of course.
What was she wearing? Aragorn went to a small desk in the corner of the kitchen and came back with a stack of photos. Glittery signs announcing Angelina's 18th birthday, paper tablecloths, what looked to be half the town in attendance. Angelina wore an orange dress with frilly arm cuffs, a Basque waist, and a matching shawl draped modestly over her front side, a not-too-revealing sweetheart neckline peeking through. She was glowing, dimpled cheeks, perfect grin. It seemed it was impossible to take a bad picture of her. Evan took out his Rome Zone, thumbed up the camera, and captured the photographs digitally. The gold locket she's wearing, Evan said. What's in it?
A wedding photograph of me and my wife.
Your wife? She lives here. Aragorn stiffened slightly.
Yes.
She prefers to keep to her room. She's less social than I am. Can I talk with her about this?
It will upset her.
That's not what I asked, Evan said. Over at the sink, Latia had stopped scrubbing to eavesdrop more intently.
If it becomes necessary,
Aragorn said, but she knows nothing. She wasn't there. She wasn't at your daughter's birthday?
No.
Evan stared at him. Aragorn stared back. Not open for discussion. Have the Leonis made contact, Evan said, asked for anything.
No, and that is even more terrifying.
Aragorn rubbed at his eyes, the pouched skin shifting beneath his thumb and forefinger.
To everyone their child is different, yes. On Santa's knee, going down a slide, first day of preschool. It's new to the world, like this is the first time it has ever happened. They are special. We all were, once.
A weighted pause. The rules of life hurt me at a young age. I can barely remember who I was before that. I hardened myself. But then, I had her. And I remembered who I once was. Even though I didn't know it, my whole life had been spent trying to earn this honor. Being her parent, I wasn't ready. Maybe no one is. He smacked his hands together. Once you have a daughter, she forces you to become a man. Or a failure. Which are you? You never know if you succeed, only if you fail. That's the joke, you see.
Aragorn took in a breath, held it.
When Angelina was a little over a year, we started taking her to Zihuatanejo for Semana Santa. And Belicia, my wife, had the stomach flu. So I had this child with me all day, every day, riding my shoulders across the sand. He held up his large hands, the veins pronounced beneath the knuckles. She held my hand to walk to the water's edge and clung to me, squawking against the cold. That belly laugh. There wasn't a single minute that whole week when we weren't touching, like we were a part of each other and always would be.
There were tears now on his cheeks, glittering streams, and he made no move to wipe them.
If they harm her, he halted. Tried again. To lose a child. It's not just her dying. It is the death of the future. It is the death of the entire world. The pan hit the sink with a clang. "Stop it," Latia barked. "She is not going to die. You will not let it happen. Your self-pity doesn't help."
Aragorn waved her off, aggravated. Evan gave the remark a moment to dissipate, and then asked, "Have you talked with the authorities?"
"The authorities?"
Aragorn snorted, wiped his face. "The rule of law is not an option. If someone steals from me, I can't go to court. If someone harms me, the police root for them. If someone takes my daughter, they assume it is a problem of my creation, a consequence of my choices. And they are right. I am outside the law. I make my own way, live by my own code, enforce my own rules. Like you."
He leaned forward, and for the first time Evan sensed menace in his deep dark eyes.
"There is nothing the law can do that I cannot do better."
"Then why don't you go to war?" Evan asked. "Hire up an army of mercs and crush them."
"Because if we go in through the front door, they will kill her. They will move her. They will make her suffer. But you know this. So why do you ask?"
"I'm gauging your temperament." Latia bustled over with a coffee pot and filled mugs for Evan and Aragorn. She lingered by Evan.
"You seem acceptable," she said.
"Good thing," Evan said, "or your nephew would have me shot the minute I walk out of the house." She gave a single shoulder shrug.
"Details."
A sudden commotion at the sliding glass door drew their attention. 6 PMCs, including the gate guards and Special K and Special Ed. Eduardo was still babying the arm Evan had declined to break. They were banging on the glass, sounding an alarm. In the background, others trotted by, surrounding the house, weapons at the ready. Evan had instructed Joey to take out the phone system as well, which had bought him some extra time. As Eduardo took in Evan sipping coffee with Aragorn, the pockmarked skin of his face shifted with surprise, then anger, then something like envy. Latia unlocked the door and slid it open.
"We were coming to alert you to an intrusion, Patron," Special Ed said as the PMCs faded away behind him. "But it seems you've discovered that."
At his side, Kiki folded his arms, the long-suffering buttons of his shirt straining to reveal lozenges of belly flesh. A powdering of dirt clung to his cheek and one ear. Raw red streaks at his wrists from the zip ties. The heel of his hand rode the butt of his holstered .44, and he looked as eager to make use of it as Special Ed looked ready to beat Evan senseless with his bare fists.
"Boys," Latia said, "come eat."
"No, thank you, Tia," Special Ed said.
"It's my migas," she said sternly.
"Sit."
Not a question. They sat. She produced another 2 plates and set them down. As the men chewed, their eyes bored holes through Evan. Evan sipped his coffee and returned their stares. Aragorn watched with an air of wry amusement.
"Misery acquaints a man with strange bedfellows," he said.
"Get all the verga measuring out of the way now, hombres.
Tenemos trabajo."
Chapter 15. In the Hands of Savages. There was nothing to be learned at the community center, nothing to be learned from the witnesses, nothing to be learned from a half-dozen interviews with Angelina's friends. The townsfolk spoke of Angelina as if she were part local mascot, part village deity. They showed Aragorn the utmost respect, and Evan had no sense that it was feigned. Surveillance cameras at the town's periphery had captured the SUVs, but the windows were tinted and the license plates removed. Aragorn figured she'd been smuggled across the border to Mexico on the night of, which put her beyond reach in a multitude of ways. With Aragorn at the wheel, they rattled back to the compound in a Jeep Wrangler flanked by security vehicles brimming with PMCs. Evan sat up front, Kiki and Special Ed crammed unhappily in the back with a few spare gas cans, waiting for an excuse to kill him. The tires shoved through the sun-bleached loam, churning up reddish clay from the subsoil, dust powdering the air. Confused by the weather, a few Guayacan trumpet trees remained in bloom, full crowns of golden flowers massaged by the breeze. White yucca flowers thrust phallically from nests of sword-shaped leaves. A lifeless bull snake sprawled across the road like a speed bump, smashed flat at axle-wide intervals. It truly was another world here. "What next?" Aragon said. They passed a field of cattle, the stink hitting them on the hot air. Evan considered the fifth commandment, his least favorite. "If you don't know what to do, do nothing." "I'm not sure yet," he said. "This nowhere man is very impressive," Eduardo piped up from the back. "Yes," Kiki said. "So far he's eaten breakfast and asked a bunch of useless questions. Maybe once he's had lunch, he will graduate to only being partially useless." Aragon waved them off. Evan shared the men's frustration at the snarl of dead ends. He'd searched Angelina's room before they'd left. Posters and makeup and fluffy throw pillows. The sugary residue of a cinnamon candle tinging the air. A piano keyboard with dog-eared sheet music on the stand. He'd leafed through her yearbooks, read the inscriptions, BFF vows, tentatively flirty entries from boys, and glowing praise from teachers. An extraordinary, yet ordinary young woman in the hands of savages. "The night she was taken, I hired a man to infiltrate the Leones," Aragon said. "We will need inside information if we hope to find her, especially if she's already in Mexico." "When will you hear from him?" Evan asked. "He's so far undercover that he will barely be able to breathe. We can only wait and pray." "Have you initiated contact with the Leones?" "Through a proxy. I was told they will contact me when they are ready." "What do you think that means?" "I have no fucking idea." "Any precipitating event between you and the Leones?" Evan asked. "Recent turf dispute? Cutting in on their market, or they on yours?" "Nothing," Aragon said. "We operate in different lanes. They're heavy into hard drugs, human smuggling and gun running. I got word that their Reynosa franchise was moving shoulder-fired surface-to-air missile launchers for $35,000 a unit." He scowled at the thought, his chin doubling. "I used to dabble in small arms. No more. We are very different. The Leones are big into posses and entourages, prostitutes and clubs. I keep a clean nose." "For a transnational drug kingpin," Evan said. Aragon shrugged. "It's relative. After Angelina was born, I decided to diversify my portfolio, move to online retail. She inspired me. Maybe not to be good, but to be less bad, to, yo no sé, do less harm." "How so?" "Why so many questions?" Special Ed asked from the back. "I have to understand your operation," Evan said, "to understand why you were targeted."
"Patron, how do you know you can trust this?"
Aragon held up his hand. "Remember where my daughter is. Trust is the least of our concerns." The road narrowed, crowded by a green burst of chipotle, hard persimmons knocking against the door panels like children begging at a border crossing.
"I only sell what our government sells," Aragon said.
"Correction, what our members of Congress, with their pockets stuffed with lobbyist cash, allow big pharmaceutical companies to sell. Oxys and Roxys and the like."
"Manufactured where?"
"China used to be promising, but they require end-user certification and it takes too long. Lately I've been bringing in pharmacy-grade stuff out of Mumbai. The bribes are heftier, but they're more reliable than the Chinese. They ship it here labeled as pool chemicals."
"Ship it here how?"
"Congress passed a law requiring electronic data tracking for all FedEx and UPS packages. So guess who we use now?" The United States Postal Service, Evan said. That's big government at work for you. Aragon chewed his lip, eyes on the road. For the European market, I warehouse it in Liberia. A beautiful laissez-faire country. Strategic location, political anarchy, modern technology. I try to make sure the meds are conflict-free, fair trade, like coffee. Not quite like the coca growers' unions in Bolivia, but I do my best to work with manufacturers who provide some measure of social benefit to their communities. You'd be surprised at how accountable business practices ensure silence, loyalty, and make more profit, too. Do you sell direct to consumer? Sometimes. We keep our sales online. In the U.S., we target states that treat off-prescription drug sales as civil violations rather than as criminal. I am insulated regardless, but that makes us less likely to draw attention. When we do, we shut down that website and port it over to another URL. Generally, I can have a fresh operation opened within the hour. The digital age is so easy. What did the Colombians have back in the 70s? Coca seeds, speedboats, a few rusty Cessnas, and yet they built one of the biggest world economies. Cojones like soccer balls. How's the money come in? The cheapest e-commerce call centers can be contracted in Manila and Haifa. The Filipinos are polite, the Israelis are not. But both are cheap, discreet, and process credit card authorizations through different financial institutions in cities with loose regulations. Pretoria, Dar es Salaam, Addis Ababa, and the like. And after that? Zurich and the Caymans have drawn scrutiny lately. So I move the money through Dubai now. Then currency swap over to dirhams, rupees, rands, rubles, gold, whatever. I doubt the Leonas are tangled up in that, Evan said, or even care. How about bulk sales? Aragon shrugged. Conducted through middlemen, encrypted comms and cryptocurrency. As with everything else, I maintain total operational security. I'm never the face of conflict. But you can't ship bulk in through the post office. No. We bring bulk in from the south, paying off the entities that control points of access. Evan's interest perked. Like who? Smuggling families, armed bands, Mexican officials who control ports, airstrips, border crossings. That's your most likely overlap with the Leones, Evan said. You use the official checkpoints. The men I pay to take the risk do, yes. How do you do it? They load the product into a trailer with a false bottom, sew it into the upholstery, stuff it into spare tires, gas tanks, false roofs. You know how long border agents have to assess each vehicle? 40 seconds. They only get around to inspecting 2% of cars. You'd take those odds at a casino any day of the week. Now, human smuggling is trickier. Humans are bigger, produce waste, need oxygen. Evan caught up to Aragon's words at the same time it seemed that Aragon did himself, the parallels to his own daughter in transit. Aragon's anger intensified. That's why the bastard Guias and Coyotes forego checkpoints and drag them through the desert wasteland. Don't care if they live or die. But drugs? Legal checkpoints make much more sense. In fact, Aragon checked his phone, thumbing across a few messages. I have a load coming over now. He jerked the wheel to the right, hammering over a ditch to vector north. It's a big one. Since you are so curious, I will make an exception to go myself and show you. The rest of the convoy screeched and veered to course correct before settling into a protective phalanx around the jeep once more. In about a half mile, they left the paved road, rumbling onto a dirt path that cut through head-high stalks of sugarcane. The field stretched for an eternity, crops thrashing against the open sides of the Wrangler, forcing Evan to lean toward the center console. The path was nothing more than a memory of tire tracks and a slight parting of the tall stalks. The way forward grew increasingly claustrophobic until it seemed they were forging into the sturdy grass itself, the fender serving as a jungle machete. Through the windshield, Evan could see only the crops beating at the glass. But somehow Eragon knew where he was going. All at once they were spit through into a cleared circle of land where a Brazilwood tree rose, framed by a squat tangle of bramble. Twilight was coming on, leaching color from the world, dusting everything into shades of sepia. The other vehicles swerved into the clearing behind them and halted. For a moment everyone waited for the dust and grit from the wheel wells to sulk away on a limp breeze. The dirt near the center was fanned out in a familiar pattern, two long strokes showing where helicopter skids had recently set down. The sugar cane rimming the circle leaned outward, beaten down by rotor wash. Aragorn emerged, Evan at his side, and headed for the bramble. Without bothering to don gloves, he reached for a thorny clump and tugged it aside. It came readily, unattached to the earth. They call this huizache. It means many thorns in Nahuatl. Useful stuff. As Aragorn swept the brush away, a hatch came clear in the ground. A few creaky twists of the metal wheel and the hatch swung open on rusty hinges, revealing a storage tank below filled with wax-encased bricks. The helo sets down right over these bramble. They unload from the belly of the chopper straight into the earth, invisible from the eyes of drones. He snapped his fingers, pointed down. Kiki tried to swing into the tank but wound up clinging to the lip, wheezing, the tip of one boot circling the hole. Aragorn rolled his eyes. Enough with this. Someone help him. He's going to have a heart attack. Special Ed hoisted Kiki out and dropped down into the hatch himself. Kiki kicked at the dirt sheepishly with the pointed toe of a cowboy boot. Sorry, Patron. I have to go back on the Weight Watchers. He patted the bulge of his belly. Special Ed hoisted himself out of the hole bearing one of the bricks. He thumbed up a blade and sliced the wax surface, the slit brimming with white pills. Aragorn grabbed a few and admired them in his palm, indistinguishable from prescription meds. They were circular or oval and bore various stamps. They're getting good at disguising it as tramadol and oxycontin. What is it really? Evan asked. New China White. Pure. Fentanyl. Evan stared down into the hatch. That's what? 80 kilos? 100. It's 50 times more potent than heroin, Evan said. So we're looking at almost 100 million overdoses? If taken improperly. Aragorn tilted his hand, let the pills spill back into the slit package. If people don't want to follow the instructions, that's on them. No, Evan said, it's not. Aragorn's face tensed. Behind him, Special Ed and Kiki went motionless. Even the PMCs at the edge of the clearing had gone on alert, perfectly still. AR-15s held at a slant, barrels aiming at a spot in the dirt between their boots and Evan's. Aragorn's shoulders tightened, and he drew himself fully erect, an unsettling effect like that of a cobra unfurling. The shift in posture gave him another few inches, forcing Evan to look up at him, Aragorn's size apparent for the first time. Aragorn's lips barely moved. What did you say? You heard me, Evan said. If you want my help, you're going to burn those pills. Are you threatening me? I'm making clear my terms, Evan said. I told you I would make demands of you that you would not like. This is the first. Oh, the first. Aragorn's eyes had a touch of wildness in them now. They'd grown larger, the sclera more pronounced. Even so, his tone was calm, measured. Are you going to go after the big pharma companies as well? Make them change their business practices? They didn't ask for my help. Aragorn took a step toward Evan. Evan held his ground. To his side he sensed Kiki's hand drift to the grip of the big .44 at his hip. Special Ed hiked his shirt up, showing off the gleaming pistol nestled against its tattooed outline on his washboard abdominals. There was, Evan realized, a good chance this would all go sideways. He charted the choreography. Half-step to pivot behind Kiki, counterclockwise momentum putting the fat man between him and the others. Chokehold with his left arm, right hand shoving Kiki's 44 back into the holster on a tilt, firing down through the top of Kiki's thigh. If Special Ed dared to shoot, Kiki's mass would be enough to absorb the 230-grain rounds from the Glock 21 in the three-quarters of a second it would take for Evan to clear leather with Kiki's gun and fire into Ed's chest at close range. The big round would knock Ed over into Aragon. Kiki would be collapsing by then, aided by Evan's knee to his kidney, which would shove him out in front. That would block the sightline of the PMCs long enough for Evan to cinch up Aragon from behind, leaving the guns for hire with nothing to target but a sliver of his face and the thin band of his forearm across Aragon's throat. Three of the PMCs stood in the open, which gave Evan easy target acquisition. He'd have four cartridges left in the 44, one for each. But the fourth man would likely park his critical mass behind an armored SUV door before Evan could get to him. He'd have a decent shot at the guy's ankle, and he'd use the precious second and a half as the man collapsed to choke drag Aragon to the ground so he could grab Special Ed's Glock 21, loaded with 14 rounds minus whatever he'd fired into Kiki. By then, the fourth PMC would be in the dirt, his vital organs visible beneath the SUV door given Evan's lower vantage, which meant the follow-up shots would penetrate gut or ribcage. In case Kiki hadn't bled out from his femoral by then, a bullet would put him down for good, removing him as a distraction. Then Evan would have Aragon, three vehicles of his choosing, and a world of possibilities. Evan kept his gaze locked on Aragon. In his peripheral vision, he sensed the heel of Kiki's hand resting on the grip of his pistol, Ed's fingers trembling above his 44. If either of them drew, Evan would have to move, and then there would be no stopping it. The PMCs wouldn't dare open up first with the big guns from across the clearing, not with Aragon in the mix. Aragon lifted a hand, pointed at the open hatch. This load is worth $160 million. How much is your daughter worth? Aragon lowered his hand to his side. His face remained placid, but there was an ice-hard coldness beneath it that reminded Evan how little he knew of the man. Aragon's nostrils flared ever so slightly, close enough that Evan could feel the heat of his breath. He kept his vision sharp yet diffuse. Kiki's hand, Special Ed's posture, the position of the PMCs. Every slight movement bringing a commensurate adjustment to the plan he hoped not to execute. The moment stretched out, and then, finally, Aragon stepped back. "Get the gas cans," he said. Special Ed and Kiki stared at him in disbelief. "Move," Aragon said. They unstuck themselves and ambled back to the Wrangler, returning with gas cans. Aragon seized one, spun the cap off, and sloshed gasoline down through the hatch. He shook the can empty, let it tumble into the subterranean storage tank. "Well, what are you waiting for?" Kiki and Special Ed scrambled into motion, emptying the contents of the remaining cans into the tank. Aragon pulled out a silver lighter and thumbed up a flame. He held it at chest level, peered at Evan over the finger of orange light. "You ask what my daughter is worth?" He flung the lighter into the storage tank. It was slow to catch, but finally a whoosh announced ignition, the earth belching a cloud of heat. Evan stepped back from the toxic chemical stench, watching the black smoke rise to the clear blue sky. After a time, Aragon kicked the hatch shut and turned to Evan. "I have enough money for 100 lifetimes." He shifted his focus to Kiki and Special Ed. "None of them are worth living without Angelina. Do you understand me?" Eduardo said,
We understand, Patron. For a moment, there was nothing but the crackling of the buried fire expending itself inside its metal prison. And then the sound of an engine cut through the noise. The PMCs fanned out, readying their AR-15s. Special Ed and Kiki had their pistols in hand, too. About a quarter mile away, the stalks began to wave. They all stared at the edge of the clearing, waiting to see what emerged. The curved edge of sugarcane stalks fluttered slightly in the breeze, as if respiring. The sound of an engine grew louder, and then another SUV pushed into sight. Everyone relaxed. Before it stopped moving, the passenger door flung open and another PMC emerged, breathless, holding a square FedEx box the size of a basketball. A pink sticker on the side read, "Priority Alert."
"This arrived for you, Patron. It came special delivery."
Aragon's voice came dry and cracked. "You scanned it for explosives." The man nodded.
"No return address.
But there is a name. It says it's from..." Aragon's face had gone bloodless.
"From whom?"
"From El Moreno." Aragon's gaze went loose, unfocused. He stared down at his boots, took a shaky breath, and then another. Fighting his way to composure, everyone waited for his face to stop trembling. At last, he lifted his eyes, and the man handed him the box.
Chapter 16. The Gravity of the Situation. Aragon stared at the FedEx box. Sweat trickled down his pronounced brow, and he shrugged a shoulder to mop it with his sleeve.
"It is cold."
His hands were shaking.
"The box
is cold." He set it on the ground. They stood around, staring down at it. Aragon held out his palm toward Evan.
"Your knife."
Evan gave him the Strider. Aragon thumbed it up. His chest rose and fell, his breathing audible. He took a knee over the box, slit the tape. The cardboard flaps lifted upward, emitting a sigh of mist. Aragon reached inside and pulled out a cooler, dry ice spilling in its wake. Blood-red lettering across the side, "Human Organ for Transplant." Aragon's breath caught. He set the cooler down on the earth gently, as if it might shatter. He reached for the lid, hesitated, closed his eyes, jerked in a few breaths, opened it. He peered inside, and his face sagged. He clutched his stomach and gave a low moan. It took a moment for Evan to realize that the sound was relief. Kiki inched forward and peered over Aragon's shoulder and then walked backward, stumbling on the blocky heels of his boots, hand over his mouth, gagging. Special Ed regarded the contents evenly.
"I guess FedEx doesn't scan for severed heads," he said.
Aragon's knees cracked as he rose. A piece of paper fluttered in his hand, a simple note, the penmanship smeared with moisture from the dry ice. "Try again, and your daughter's head will be delivered next." Evan stepped forward and looked down into the box. Greasy hair, crusted eyes, sallow skin, gaping mouth with cracked, pale lips, a black well where the tongue should be. The decapitation mark was clean, no marks from a serrated edge. A big blade, probably a machete. Evan cleared his throat. "You're undercover, man?" Aragon nodded, the color starting to return to his face.
"Send his widow and children money,"
he said to Special Ed.
"How much?"
Already he was walking back to the jeep, his gait now steady. "Whatever they need." The PMCs at the compound noted the caravan's arrival, the armored front gate rumbling open as they approached. Evan's rented SUV remained where he'd left it, parked at a slant facing the wall. Aragon didn't slow, the jeep nearly clipping the Buick before squeezing through the moving gate with no more than a few inches to spare on either side. They rattled across the hard earth for a time, and then the bizarre square of suburbia came into view. Aragon pulled into the driveway, a middle-class father returning from a day's work. They unpacked from the vehicle, the night air crisp in Evan's lungs. As Aragon and his men headed inside, Evan said, "I need a minute." Aragon didn't seem to register that he'd spoken at all. Once the men disappeared into the house, Evan strode the property's perimeter, walking that razor's edge between inhospitable South Texas dirt and the lush grass where the yard began. The house was more than a house. It was an act of will, stubbornly nourishing a patch of civilization to life. Shadowed beneath the eaves of the house, a row of surveillance cameras swiveled to hold him in sight, the glint of their lenses barely visible in the darkness. He took out his room zone and called Joey. She picked up against a white noise storm of commotion in the background, the clatter of equipment and men speaking in raised voices. "You're alive," she said. "Good. Now you can come home and deal with construction guys who are like the worst, especially to people with girl parts." "Joey, I mean the cable guy's all like, I'll be there in this 6-hour window," and I'm like, "Of course, why would I expect you to actually be able to set a human being time like, dunno, a brain surgeon or senior partner in a law firm?" "And then they're all like," Evan said, "I don't need cable." "Whatevs." Fuzz filled his ear. Joey must have pressed the phone against her chest, though it barely muted her shouting. "Excuse me, does the so-called Excelsior package include someone who knows how to install wireless speakers right side up?" Evan couldn't make out the muffled retort, only the guy's disconsolate tone. "Well, I appreciate your concern, but I do want to worry my pretty little head about it," Joey said. "Oh, and I should warn you, I subsist on the bitter tears of dude bros, so please keep pushing me. I haven't been fed yet today." "Joey!" "What?" "I'm in the middle of something here." "Is it as stressful as a remodel?" "Probably not." Evan eyed the cameras once more. "Are you still in Orea's surveillance system?" A faint tap-tap-tap of her footfalls as she moved to privacy. He could only imagine the dude bro installer's relief. "Nope," she said, lowering her voice. "They closed the loophole, kicked me out right after our little stunt. I can't have your back anymore, X." "That's okay. Aragon and I are coming to an understanding." "Do you know how insane you sound?" "Yes." "Don't forget who he is," she said. "I'm texting you pictures of Angelina from the night she was taken, what she was wearing, jewelry, all that. And some images of the SUVs that took her, though I don't know how useful they'll be since they ditched the plates. I need to know anything you can find out about the Leones, everywhere they're operating in Mexico, the U.S., all of it."
"Okay. The pictures are coming through now and..."
"Hey! Ponytail!" Evan started, nearly dropping the phone. "Pro tip," Joey yelled at someone. "Don't show up drunk to a job requiring nail guns." Muted sounds of remorse. "Sure you're not drunk. Dude, you have Cookie Monster eyes. Out! And eat a sleeve of Mentos." Back to Evan.
"I have to go. The tile guys just showed up and they only speak Croatian."
"Do you have Bosnian?" Evan asked.
"Nope."
"Serbian?"
"Nope."
"Polish?"
"Passable."
40% overlap.
"I was today years old when I learned that."
"Between Polish and Google Translate, you should muddle through."
"I always do."
"Don't do anything more stupid than usual. I don't have time to come rescue you." "Your concern is heartwarming."
"Hey, wait, these are supposed to be ceramic, not porcelain."
She started yelling in Polish before she cut the line. Evan stood a moment beneath the vast Texas sky before heading inside. The men were sitting around the kitchen table, the mood somber, the FedEx box centered between them like a salad bowl. Aragon nodded to a chair, and Evan sat. Aragon tugged at his mouth, pulled it down hard enough to make the outer edges of his eyes sag. He gave a sigh, the stale air reaching across the table. His hand pressed firmly across his mouth, thumb shoving his cheek up at one side. wrinkles bunched at the corner of his right eye, his gaze haunted. The misplaced book on the shelf in the living room called to Evan's OCD, but he kept it purposefully out of his line of sight, not giving in to the compulsion to glare at it. Eragon set his palms on the table as if grounding himself against the wood. There is a tear inside most men's brains, through which they sometimes glimpse the things they don't allow themselves to think. And it scares them so much, they do everything in their power to wall themselves off from that place. From the unthinkable. Pleading eyes, the eyes of a man consigned to hell. I live in that place. Among those thoughts. That's where my daughter and I are together right now. These... His gesture took in the kitchen and the men, the house and the world beyond. This is a dream to me. We find her here, though, Evan said, not in your nightmares. Eragon steadied himself with a breath. I think you're right about the border crossings being the likely point of contention between me and these putos. I've dug up plenty of intel on the Leones. So now that Plan A came back to us in a fair Xbox, I will send these two, a nod to Kiki and Special Ed, to find out what loads the Leones are moving, where they are vulnerable, overextended. Perhaps that will shed light on what they want from me. He suddenly looked weary beyond his years. They poison their product. Heroin with chocolate-flavored baby milk, meth with MSM, cocaine with laundry detergent. He waved a hand. Or worse. Unlike you, Evan said, the organic drug dealer. Eragon's dark eyes lifted to meet Evan's. They did not look amused. I do not cheat my customers. I treat my people with respect. I do not lie. I am not like them. A rapping on the door interrupted the stare-off, and Special Ed rose to answer. Three PMCs crowded the doorway with their body armor and semi-automatic rifles. They conversed with Ed in hushed tones, and then Eduardo turned to face them across the foyer. There's a problem with the Garcia boy, the eldest. He's in the SUV. A pause. I told you he was no good. We were all no good, Eragon said, until we weren't. He waved them in. Bring him here. Are you out of your mind? Latia had appeared at the top of the stairs, clutching her bathrobe at her throat. Her hair was up in curlers, her face a ghostly white, smeared with some kind of cream. It's too late to do business here at the house. You wake Belicia. She came down a few steps and halted, shoulders back, chin aloft. What's in the FedEx box? A head, Eragon said. I see. Well, whatever you boys have to contend with tonight, you can contend with it outside this house. She fluttered her hand, shooing them all. The PMCs had halted sheepishly in the foyer. Should we meet you elsewhere then, Patron? One of them asked. Eragon rose with a groan, pressed a hand to his lower back. Out back. They shuffled out beneath Latia's disapproving gaze. Evan didn't fully comprehend the gravity of the situation until it was too late. The men were gathered well back from the house, light spilling from the downstairs windows and one upstairs. Latia came visible in the second-story room, glaring out at them before shaking her head and clicking off the light. Evan could have sworn he sensed the curtains stir in the neighboring window, Belicia's room, but couldn't be sure. Where the backyard ended, there was nothing but flat earth stretching unbroken into the darkness. Before them at the lawn's edge, a half-dozen rolls of sod were stacked like massive log cakes, dark soil wrapping green interiors. The dirt had been churned up in anticipation of the sods being laid, a trio of shovels protruding from the ground. A waning crescent moon looked down with disinterest, illuminating the men, a thicket of salt cedar in the distance, and little else. The Garcia boy stood before the semicircle of men. An unattractive kid,
He looked to be in his mid-teens, pimple-faced, slump-shouldered, a few wisps on his upper lip, surly but scared enough that he didn't dare conjure attitude. One of the PMCs leaned on a shovel. Garcia hugged himself against the cold and tried not to shiver. He wore a black T-shirt, the skin of his arms goosebumped against the night. He was doing everything in his power not to look at the shovels or the sod ready to unroll across the waiting earth like a coffin lid. Evan took measure of the weaponry. They had enough firepower to bring down an armored truck. He had a knife and a bad ankle. Aragon swung his heavy jowled face to the first PMC.
You have me out here dealing with this while my daughter is missing. So get to it. What did he do?
He was supposed to deliver a car to that judge in Hidalgo, the PMC said, with the briefcase in the trunk. Never got there. The Garcia boy emitted a low moan of terror. The air smelled of mulch and fertilizer and decay. Aragon asked, what happened? He won't say. Aragon cocked an eyebrow, studied Garcia.
Won't you? I did.
They just won't believe me.
The boy jerked in a few breaths.
There was a checkpoint outside of Mercedes. Cars backed up for 100 yards. I got nervous. I left the car.
Says he just ran away, the PMC said, from the car and the briefcase in the trunk. No sign of the car now, of course.
Do you know what was in that briefcase, mijo?
Aragon asked. Garcia shook his head.
That's good,
Aragon said. None of you do.
I should have stayed with your vehicle, patron. I should have turned around and driven off and fought them off if they came after me.
No,
Aragon said.
No. If you're ever going to get caught, you run or surrender.
We can always handle it in court. You don't ever threaten the life of a police officer. Do you understand?
Garcia nodded. Evan eased out a breath. That's not all, the PMC said. His payment for the delivery? He says it went missing, that he left it in the car as well.
Something in the quality of the air seemed to shift. Special Ed and Kiki alerted, their eyes flashing.
Aragon drew himself upright as he had before Evan in the clearing.
You left the envelope, Aragon said flatly, in the car.
The boy nodded. An unusual choice, Aragon observed. It could fit in a pocket, correct? The boy's cheeks flushed, bringing up splotches under the acne. His arms trembled, and not just from the cold. The land felt dark and open and desolate, the stars out in force, the only witnesses to what might take place. Evan felt the thrum of his heartbeat in the side of his throat. The 10th commandment, never let an innocent die. He edged a half step forward, but Special Ed drew his pistol, aiming at the ground in front of Evan's toes. The PMCs eased back, bringing their barrels to a casual slant, sighted at Evan's thighs. He wouldn't get two steps without losing both legs. Aragon took notice of nothing but the boy, his eyes remaining locked on the kids.
Why would you drive to Hidalgo County and keep that kind of money on the passenger seat?
I don't know.
Or in the glove box. Is that where you kept it?
The glove box. Garcia's lips moved, but no sound came out at first. Then a whisper, the words barely audible.
Siento, lo siento, lo siento.
You're sorry, Aragon said. What are you sorry for? Leaving the money in the car?
Garcia blinked sweat from his eyes and shook his head, sweat heavy bangs swaying across his greasy forehead.
I lied.
He could barely choke the words out.
I gave the money to my mama. She has the bone disease, osteo, something, where everything breaks. Her wrist, her hip.
She's been rationing her pills, cutting them in quarters. They are so expensive. And she can't work, and my dad isn't around, and my brothers, they are little. And I promised her I'd be bringing in money for her pills. But the checkpoint...
He started crying, white residue at the corners of his mouth gummed up as he sobbed.
So you decided to steal from me instead of coming to me honestly and asking for what you need, Aragorn said, leaning in, his nose inches from the boy's.
Evan said, Aragorn. Aragorn's hand shot out so quickly that Evan almost grabbed it instinctively and goosenecked the wrist. But it stopped just shy of his face, finger raised in a shut-the-fuck-up warning. Aragorn never even broke eye contact with Garcia.